Welcome to this edition of the Alabama Historical Association's podcast program. I'm your host, Marty Olaf, and I talk with people who conduct interesting research and do interesting things concerning Alabama history. You can find out more about the Alabama Historical Association, a membership organization devoted to Alabama history, by pointing your browser at our website, www.alabamahistory.net.
Our guest is Allie Lopez, a PhD candidate in history at Baylor University. She is the winner of the Alabama Historical Association's 2024 Clinton, Jackson, and Evelyn Coley Research Award for her project, the title of which is The Injustice That Permeates, Jim Crow, Fear, and Dispossession in Rural Alabama, 1930 to 1985. Allie, thank you for speaking with us today, and congratulations on the Coley Research Award.
Thank you for having me, Marty. I'm really glad to be here.
Tell us about your project.
My project has shifted, as many PhD students' projects shift throughout their graduate studies. I completed my undergrad at the University of North Alabama. And while I was there, I was really interested in Black women's activism in the civil rights movement. I wrote my senior thesis on Black women's activism and how it shifts from single-sex organizations to working with men more often in organizations like SNCC and the SCLC and things like this in the mid-20th centuries. I wrote about those shifts. And so when I came to Baylor, I was really interested in continuing to study women's activism in the civil rights movement. I wrote seminar papers and took independent studies and courses that informed that research. And then while I was doing my comprehensive exams, I started to have more questions, different questions than I had when I initially came into graduate school. And one of the things that I was looking at, because comprehensive exams, you read a breadth of historical studies, I was really interested in the approaches of folks who study slavery, who consider how difficult resistance is to slavery, focusing on structures that inhibit resistance to slavery. That became very interesting to me. Walter Johnson and Marissa Fuentes and Sadia Hartman talk about this. I began to read, too, about white structures in the civil rights era, these structures that make resistance extremely difficult, particularly in rural areas. These structures are in place. They look different, of course, but they're still in place. They're white people who hold political power, economic power in these communities. It makes it extremely difficult for people to join into activist organizations, or it makes it extremely difficult to resist the structures. I became interested in what are these structures like at the county level in the Alabama Black Belt and South Central Alabama in particular. This particular judge owns land where he employs sharecroppers, and he also controls the political system in the county. So it makes it extremely difficult for people who are on that land to register to vote. So sometimes they express different interests, Black people in rural communities, Black men and women who are really concerned about preserving their economic status as best they can, even though it's not necessarily good, but ensuring that they can maintain a job, no matter how difficult that job is or how exploitative that job is. They often express awareness of how exploitative the conditions that they're working under are, but that resistance to those conditions, they're not quite sure that that's going to change them necessarily. So looking at those structures is where my project has tended toward and how people approach activism differently in these communities, because the communities look different. We often focus on urban areas in our studies of civil rights, and for good reason sometimes too, like Birmingham, Selma, Montgomery, very important to look at those communities during the civil rights era. But things are playing out differently in these rural communities, I think. And so that's the direction of my project so far.
Do you have a specific region that you're looking at in particular?
Yes, I'm looking at South Central Alabama, the Alabama Black Belt counties, but also some of the surrounding counties, especially majority Black counties from the 30s to the 70s. Some of that shifts without migration at different points. But yeah, so the majority Black counties in South Central Alabama are the focus of the study.
How many of them?
That's a good question. I think the Black Belt is roughly a 16-county area. So I've been looking at Hill County, Sumter, Choctaw, Macon, Tallapoosa, Bibb County. Some of those counties are a little bit out of the Black Belt, but they're still in this majority Black, mostly agricultural work, especially early mid 20th century. Those are the counties that I'm looking at so far.
I like this quote that you have in your proposal. They, meaning people that had been accused, you might say, of not paying much attention, of not actively engaging in the quest for voting rights and for civil rights, were not asleep, apathetic, or unaware. They were living in white-controlled regions designed to make resistance nearly impossible. Do you stand by that quote from your proposal? Is that what you were finding out?
Absolutely. I'm excited to get into archives, but I've also found these great rural sociological studies, one by Charles S. Johnson called The Shadow of the Plantation, which is a study of Macon County in the 1930s. And he interviews a lot of sharecroppers and tenant farmers in Macon County. Almost all of them say that they know that they're being exploited by a white landowner, but they pose this question, what are we supposed to do? Like, they control everything in the county. They control everything in the community. What does it look like to resist these structures when these are the people who are enforcing the laws in our community? So you'll hear people say things like, civil rights is all to the good, but who's going to enforce it here? It's not an unawareness or an apathy toward change. People in rural communities are very interested in change. It's more of a question of how is that change going to be implemented? And what will my resistance actually change? Or will it worsen my conditions in this community because of the people who hold power? And I think often people in rural communities who don't join civil rights movement can kind of be written off as not caring about change, but they really do. It's just that they're so aware of the conditions that they're working under, the conditions that they're living under, that they question what changes are possible. The structures themselves make people have those questions because the structures make it extremely difficult to resist those who hold positions of power in the community.
I think you kind of edge into touching on something else. You speak of the institutions of existing power, and particularly in the 1930s, the resistance to resisting by individuals that were captured in this sociological survey. But as time went on, there became some mechanisms of resistance. You spoke earlier of SNCC and the NAACP. Those barely existed in the 1930s. So people who wanted to resist exploitation either had to find another way to do it, or they had to risk being an individual against entrenched power.
I think that's something interesting, too. Another study that scholars have used, that's Theodore Rosengarten's All God's Dangers with Ned Cobb, Nate Shaw in the book, but Ned Cobb in real life. Ned Cobb joins the Alabama Sharecroppers Union and ends up being thrown in prison for 13 years. And then when he comes out of prison, he returns to a life of farming and exploitative conditions in Tallapoosa County. This is something that I noticed recently. He talks at the end of his book about how his sons wish that he would stop talking about resistance and wish that he would stop talking about resisting these structures in the community because they feel that it only exacerbates the conditions that they're living under. He's talking to Rosengarten in the 70s. So even though there are organizations that come in like SNCC and the SCLC and do organize local people, that does happen, there are still plenty of people who are questioning how much change can result from those organizations pushing for voting rights or things like that in those communities too.
This will be your dissertation, am I correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And when it first started out, the award was pretty good size. Now that's kind of shrunk down in spending power. So what are you going to use this money for?
I'm planning to research at the Alabama Department of Archives and History in Montgomery. Fortunately, I'm from Alabama, so I do know some folks in Montgomery. So I'm able to stretch that money a little bit further, which is fortunate. I'll be looking at governor's papers and correspondence while I'm there, especially related to rural communities, race relations, and things like this. They also have WPA narratives that will be really interesting and helpful. A little bit of that is available online, but not a lot. So I'm really interested to see those collections in person. They also have some county level records like probate court, things like this, case files. And so I'm interested to see what's there. Sometimes it's nothing, and then sometimes it's really, really helpful information. So that's always the interesting thing about going into an archive. You never quite know what you're going to find. That's another part I'm excited about, too, is to get to talk to the archivists at the ADAH and tell them about the project and see what they think would be useful because they're experts in the collections. Those are my preliminary plans for looking at the ADAH, but I'm planning to go in June.
Now, you've presented at the 2024 Alabama Historical Association meeting in April. What was your presentation topic?
Yes, so I presented on the reverse freedom rides. After the freedom rides in 1961 that were launched by CORE and SNCC, white citizens' councils across the South launched the reverse freedom rides, which is where they sought to recruit Black Southerners, particularly in rural areas, who were willing to move to northern cities, Chicago, areas in Massachusetts, places like this. So white citizens' councils would collect money from white people in their communities, then ship Black Southerners and their families, often entire families, to the north. Particularly, they select rural Black women who are dependent on welfare. They frame these women as drains on the community, that the community would be better off if they didn't have to support these women and their families. They have this ideal candidate for a reverse freedom rider. And then they ship these women and their families to the north. And then often the women express that they would like to move back because their family members are often still there. They still have lives there. And they're often abandoned once they arrive in the north. So they don't have a job or housing unless an organization like the NAACP steps in and helps them once they're there. But if that doesn't happen, then they're kind of abandoned and without money. And then they can't qualify for welfare in these counties because you have to live there for at least a year. But the Citizens Council will typically refuse to help them. The reverse freedom rides of 1962 fade out, and the White Citizens Council fades out as well with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and things like this. Those people who are a part of the Citizens Council still remain in positions of power. So they're often mayors or they join government agencies and things like this. And so they end up influencing welfare policies later on that discriminate particularly against Black women.
What are your sources for the reverse freedom rides?
I actually found the story in the Sparkman papers at the Hull Collections in Tuscaloosa. There was a letter from a Citizens Council member to Senator Sparkman that said something along the lines of, "We're making an effort to ship Mamie Lee Underwood and her family to the North." And I was like, "Who's Mamie Lee Underwood? What is happening here?" I started to search on newspapers.com and found that there was a lot of coverage of Mamie Lee Underwood and her family being shipped from Bibb County by the Citizens Council there to the north. I used different newspapers, including the Centerville Press and then other Alabama newspapers, and then also some African American newspapers that covered those stories too. So those are my primary sources there. And then that letter that I found, which was a good find.
That letter sounds like it is the thing that spurred your interest in this topic.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You already said that you graduated from the University of North Alabama, and my note says that you graduated in history and English in 2020, summa cum laude.
Yes, I did. I'm originally from Gunnersville, Alabama. Then went to UNA for my undergraduate studies, where I majored in English and history. It's actually, I did not like history upon entering into college. I had wonderful teachers, but I was not particularly interested in history after high school. But I had excellent professors at UNA who convinced me to double major in English and history. And throughout my time at UNA, I became really interested in becoming a history professor and becoming a teacher. Then also started to research while I was at UNA. So there was a project called the Civil Rights Struggle in the Shoals Project. I worked as a research assistant on that. So then I also became quite interested in research. I was doing a lot with newspapers then and looking at microfilm at the library all the time. I became really interested in research and teaching. And so that was kind of how I chose to go to graduate school. But yeah, originally from Alabama, still my family is still all there. So I'm the only person who's left. I'm in Texas, so.
Do you have any plans after you graduate that are likely to come to fruition?
I have at least one more year here, depending on life and writing and research and how that goes. It could be a little bit longer, as anyone who knows a little bit about graduate school knows. But after I finish my studies here, I really would like to teach. I've had the opportunity to teach here at Baylor, which has been wonderful, and I really enjoy working with students. So I hope to pursue an opportunity to both teach and continue in my research. That would be my ideal position in the future. We always hear about the job market, but I'm hopeful that that is a possibility. So we'll see.
Well, fingers crossed for you. What have I forgotten? What do you need to add?
I think we covered a lot. I did want to ask you, do you have any tips for, have you researched at the ADAH? Was there anything you found interesting?
ADAH and I are on first name basis. I can't give you any tips necessarily because as often as I go there, every time I go in, I kind of forget how things operate. But I will tell you one thing that I learned the hard way. And way back when the research room was on the other side of the building where the gift shop is now, I went in and I had a mechanical pencil. And so I didn't use the mechanical pencil to fill out those three-part call forms. I used a pen and I gave it to the person at the desk who I will not name, but is a friend of mine, waited until I got all the way across the room. And then he yelled at me for filling that out in pen. So do not take a pen in the reading room. Just don't take it in whatsoever. That's my big tip. And rely on the reference archivists. They know their stuff and they know how to help you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Our guest today has been Ali Lopez, a PhD candidate in history at Baylor University, who is the recipient of the Alabama Historical Association's 2024 Clinton, Jackson, and Evelyn Coley Research Award for her project entitled The Injustice That Permeates, Jim Crow, Fear, and Dispossession in Rural Alabama, 1930 to 1985. Allie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today. This has been another edition of the Alabama Historical Association podcast program. Our music is the traditional tune Whistle By, performed at City Stages in 1996 by James Bryan and Carl Jones. It's provided courtesy of the Alabama Folklife Association, which you can find on the web at alabamafolklife.org.